I'll write it and we'll do it live.
The music I get, it starts my feet tapping and I get all happy inside.
You will not laugh. You will not cry. You will learn by the numbers. I will teach you.
Would you stop with the dime drumming?
You ain't got no problem, Jules. Then wait for the wolf, who should be coming directly.
You sending the wolf?
I'm just having the time, having the time.
I want all of you to enjoy your cake. So, enjoy.
Drums. I don't like the sound of those drums. An Indian hollered back, he ain't our regular drummer.
Dude, I freaking love our listeners.
Kind of coming alive again, isn't it?
It's unbelievable, man. I mean, we come back from a 3-month hiatus and we have more people listening than we did before. What does that say about our silence? People like that more.
No, I think they just miss my jaded indifference.
Well, they're going to get a lot of that today.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I want to take a minute, though, in all sincerity, talk about our listeners for a second, because on the first two episodes of this new season, we've gotten a lot of response and just overall a lot of total listens. But the one thing in particular, and I'm not going to call out any names or anything, but I want to talk about a few emails and messages that we've gotten over the last couple of weeks. And the first one was in response to our episode that we did when we started off the season, the performance panic and neurosis. And we used one of our terms that we love to use on this show. It's when you're in trouble, you dig a trench, right?
Right.
We've talked about that all the time. And we had a listener in Eastern Europe that sent me an awesome email. And I love it. A little raw on the language, but he said that he loved the quote that when he gets in trouble, he likes to get in the ditch. And that's not
lay in a ditch.
Yeah.
The tornado's coming.
Yeah. And not exactly what we said. We said dig a trench, not get in the ditch. but the sentiment is there.
I think, and musically, I think he gets it. So musically, that in itself is a winner.
Musically, he totally gets it.
Yeah. That's most important.
Yeah, he's going to get in the ditch. So you rock on, Eastern Europe.
There's going to be a number of people in Siberian town he lives in or wherever that is going to be grateful. Like, man, this guy is just laying it down.
He's in that ditch, baby.
In it.
Laying it down. That's exactly right. And then also I wanted to mention about the Danny Reyes interview.
Fine job, sir.
Oh, thank you so much. It's hard to go wrong when you got that guy sitting across from you. I mean, he is... He's amazing, man. Aside from being arguably the finest Latin pop percussionist on the face of the planet today, he's an equally great guy and such a calming, very voice of reason sort of presence that I got this message the other day that said that Danny needs to have an app for a phone where you can just push a button and it's like a calming Daniel De Los Reyes affirmation for the day. And I'm like, you know what? That's a pretty good idea.
I'd wear that out.
I'm telling you, because I mean, the entire kind of timbre and tenor for that entire interview was sort of like, guys, just listen to me. I've made enough mistakes and done enough gigs for everyone combined. I will steer you clear and through to the other side.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, man, that guy's something else.
He's got a spirit for sure. Like we did, he was on that Steve Gadd show.
That's where I met him.
And man, it was definitely, you felt his presence in nothing but a positive way. And he's one of those players too, like such a monster, but is bringing things out of you as opposed to, you know, like just stomping on you and vibing you. He's one of those guys that just kind of you come out of your shell. And I always picture, like, I'm playing with someone like that and I'm like kind of hovering above, like, am I really playing that? Mm-hmm. Oh my god, you know, he brings it out. He's one of those spirits. Pretty cool.
And more importantly, and I alluded to it on the show, but I'll elaborate just a tad more. When I was in his house, his entire basement where he has his studio, it's full of different things that are part of his philanthropic endeavors. For example, he had stacked up up against one wall probably 75 boxes of medical supplies that he's shipping to Puerto Rico. Wow. And so you dig, I mean, he's got Dayglow, right? He's got his music school. But it's so much deeper than that. And it's one of those things that this guy, he talks the talk, but more importantly, he walks the walk.
Right on.
It is, he is 100% genuine with what he's doing. And again, he didn't even mention this stuff. I'm the one bringing it up. You know, he didn't even mention it. We talked about Dayglow on the show, but he didn't necessarily talk as much about the other philanthropic things he's doing. So, I mean.
Well, I'll say this. I've had some interaction with his brother, too, and
Wally,
that's a really special family, and that starts mm-hmm. at, you know, their grandfather was into it too. So there's, besides being an incredible lineage of amazing musicians, that's just really good people, quality folk.
I want to get him back.
Appreciate all that.
I want to get him back for a second show.
Cool.
He's 100% worthy of a second show. And then I want to go ahead and mention this also, because we have had such a tremendous response from these first few episodes, that today's show will mark the third waypoint, or we will be one third of the way through the second season, because we're going to do 10 shows in this second season.
And take a break.
And then take a break. So it's flying by already, John. We can already see the finish line.
Thank God.
I knew you. I did it.
I mean, sorry.
It is partially for your benefit, of course.
Yeah, and yours, so I don't go absolutely insane.
So let's talk about today's show. Today, we are going to welcome a guest. We're going to have another one of John's favorite third mic shows. Right, John?
And my favorite drummer.
I'm telling you.
It's like a double whammy there.
Well, the third mic show, which we introduced kind of toward the end of our first 2 years of doing this, was such a ridiculously smashing success that it's going to be a recurring theme in all upcoming seasons.
That's good, man. I know I've said plenty that took my credibility and just it went out the window. So we bring other people in, man.
So we can destroy their credibility.
Well, that's a given, yeah. I'm going to weave my way into discrediting him throughout the show, but nonetheless, you know, at least we're buying like 7 or 8 more shows worth of I'll give him another shot, that guy, you know.
So let's do this. To get into our topic, why don't you introduce our guest? I'll introduce the topic and then we'll go for it.
Okay. Our guest today, you heard him, you probably thought it was another one of my personalities mumbling or giggling throughout that intro, but our friend Marlon Patton's here today.
Hello.
And man, those of you that know him, there really needs to be no introduction, but those of you that don't, there is no better, complete, and, you know, more giving musically individual I know of. And I say that because I've heard him in so many different settings and just delivering endlessly, and it's inspiring, and I can't thank him enough for I'll get to you thanking you for coming on the show in a little while, but
okay.
You know, just what you do, man, and what you give to our community, and how, you know, you set a bar, it is something that I don't take lightly, and I think you'd be absolutely shocked at how many people feel the same way. So
thank you, John. I appreciate that, man.
Really, really awesome, man. Always inspired on every level with Marlon. So here we are, and I'm excited.
I want to say one quick thing about this also. You probably don't remember this, man. But the first time I heard you play was, God, man, it was probably going on 9 years ago. It was either 8 or 9 years ago.
Really?
And do you remember there was a benefit that we played that was for a friend of ours that was doing an adoption at that time. And it was down in Little Five Points. I can't remember the venue. It's right. What's that venue, man? That's right beside Variety Playhouse.
Is it aisle five or was the
five spot? It was the five spot.
Uh-huh.
Was what it was.
Yeah.
And I remember who you played with. I can't remember who I played with.
Who did I play with?
Yeah, you were with Will.
Will Scruggs?
You were with Will. Yeah.
I do remember that.
Yeah. And man, you were all gimped up that day, man. You had like a crutch or a cane or something.
I broke my ankle that year and had to play without a hi-hat.
And came in and played your tail off, though,
man.
And because I remember sitting back at the bar, and I was like, man, I wonder if this guy's going to be it, you know? And man, he came up and just freaking burned it down.
And you know, man, there was a collective sigh of relief when he did that. And you know, oh, he's injured, man. We all have a chance. And it's like, nah.
What does that say that I can't even remember who I played with on that day?
That says he was, his no hi-hat playing ass was bringing it.
Yeah, I cannot remember who I played with.
I think I remember Cadillac
day.
Jones was there as well, maybe, or something. I don't know. But
Yeah.
I would say playing without a hi-hat is a huge learning experience.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think everyone should do it. Everyone should break their ankle.
I saw Josh Freese play one time with he was playing with Devo. I like Devo. We're going down the freaking rabbit hole now. He had a broken leg in a cast, man. Mm-hmm. And his leg was just sticking straight out. And he played and killed it, man.
Of course he did.
Just destroyed it. So
he's playing with Sting now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's really killing it, man. Awesome. He sounds great.
He's a good dude.
Yeah.
Kind of a real edge to the
that he does, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got energy to burn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what we're going to talk about today.
Oh, mm-hmm. Man. I'm not done talking about it.
Well, go ahead. Go for it.
No, I'm done.
So, well, today's topic is a topic that I would venture to guess that everybody who's listening to this show has talked about it before, bounced it off one another, but maybe hasn't really
even suffered at the hand of
possibly so
indifference or elitism for sure,
but really hasn't dug into it, really hasn't gotten into the topic and really figured out what makes it what it is. And what that topic is, we're going to call it the jazz versus rock drummer's mindset, because it's different. It's a very different type thing, and there's a lot of intangibles involved with it. There's a lot of subtleties involved with it. And I thought what we would do is we would take three guys who have all done these different things, tried to play as authentically as you can in a jazz setting and then as authentically as you can in a rock setting, and explain what these differences are, because there are some significant differences in those mindsets. And one of the things that John and I have talked about a ton of times is that we both have these different groups that we play with. And for example, if we're playing in our big corporate band where we have to drive the large nail with the large hammer, so to speak, we sometimes have friends that kind of exclusively play in the jazz community that will come up to us and go, man, if you ever need a sub sometime, I want to be on the list. And, you know, it's flattering in some ways, but we kind of roll our eyes a little bit in some ways as far as like, when's the last time you've really played a backbeat gig? When's the last time you've ever had to play with a click on a gig or a sequence on a gig? And there's a big difference. There's a huge difference in the mindset. It would almost be the same thing as going to a piano trio gig and expecting sequences to be played, mm-hmm. you know, when you do it. And it's just, it's a different type of culture. It's a different kind of mindset. And so the first thing I want to talk about is, let's talk about the difference between the song structures of a jazz standard or a bebop tune versus the structure of like a rock or pop tune. And the first thing I'll say about it, as far as like the difference is overall, if you think about the structure of a jazz tune, well, we'll take a standard, for example, it's a repetitive revolving structure the majority of the time. That would be what we'd call a traditional song form, an AABA song form. Sometimes it would be what we'd call a first half, second half song form. And it's a repetitive cycle. You play melodies and you play solos over top of it and so on. Seldom will it change unless there's some type of a tag that's put on toward the end of it. Whereas a lot of rock tunes, for lack of a better term, can be through composed. There's not necessarily a very repetitive song structure. You've got verses, pre-choruses, choruses. You'll have the nebulous guitar solo or something that'll come in every now and then. You might have a bridge, that type thing. And that's the first thing I kind of want to bring to the table, is that you have to think in terms of being flexible and rolling with it when you're playing a standard, as opposed to when you're playing in a rock setting. You got to know that freaking tune.
Yeah.
Right, John?
Yeah, man. That,
way to bring the energy, brother.
Well, I'm just worn out because you just won't. Oh. No, I completely agree. It's such a different mindset, and we witness the indifference to different genres sometimes about, like, oh, you know, it's just pop or it's just groove or you know, why that boring jazz that never stops, you know. But man, to own it, you gotta get in the middle of that stuff. And I think, Marlon, you probably crossed those lines as well as anyone I know. And maybe your opinion and your insight can help some people to get out of their own way.
Yeah, well, I would say I'm fortunate to have toured rock or pop stuff, and also toured with jazz stuff. And I will say that it's a different set of challenges. Like, you know, when you're playing the same exact thing every night, you come up with a challenge. I'm talking rock stuff right now. You're playing the same arrangement, same 4-minute songs, same, you know, 3 to 5 minute songs. You zero in on a different kind of thing. So you zero in on a groove and a specific feel, like maybe the way you and the bass player are linking up or something. So it's a completely different set of challenges, or like a certain fill that you can't quite get in the pocket. You want to put that, just nail it, you know, get it perfectly in the pocket going in a bridge or something like that. But the, like, touring with jazz, even if you are playing the same set every night, which is highly unlikely, you're working on a completely different, you're trying to bring a creative sense to the song in a different way every single night, you know, and that's a whole other challenge. And you can get caught up in a lot of challenges in that, because maybe you might start a solo the same way you did the night before, and then that boxes you into something that you maybe don't want to be in, you know. So it's way more a cerebral challenge, and then I feel like a rock gig is way more of a physical challenge of, like, I want to nail this, like, harder than I ever have before, even though it's the same thing and it's minutia a little bit.
A discipline too. Like, sometimes I try to get more in that mindset of, like, the challenge of playing consistent night to night on a tour that is more along the lines of pop or rock stuff. It's like, instead of viewing it as a drag or as a, you know, just like, oh, I'm boxed in. Like, no, the challenge of, like you said, nailing it every night, you know, being consistent, or that one fill that you're just almost there. Like, yeah, I'm going to get it tonight.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is I think it's overlooked a lot.
Yeah.
And man, too. The dudes doing it at a high level, they're getting hired for a reason. And that's it, that every night, man.
Absolutely.
That person out front ain't even thinking about this cat back here, because it's so together.
Little John.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Yeah, 20 years with an artist, you're doing something right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, there's an interesting sort of phenomenon that I discovered years ago when I was at Memphis, when I was in graduate school. I heard on two separate occasions the exact opposite things coming from one guy who was primarily a jazz player and one guy who's primarily a rock player. And it really stuck with me. And there was a rock player that was so enamored with guys that played straight ahead. And he didn't understand the concept of what it's like to play. And he didn't understand the concept of song form. And he thought that all this stuff was just this unrelated nobody knew where they were going sort of thing, but yet everybody got there.
Completely right? free kind of
Thought
thing.
It was just completely free.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, the guy that was primarily the straight ahead player was absolutely enamored at this other guy who played rock, because this other guy that played rock was playing these incredibly complex progressive rock tunes. And the other guy couldn't figure out how this guy could memorize how the complexity of these arrangements, mm-hmm. where he would go through this one section that all of a sudden would be these odd times, and he would go to this next section that would kind of release and go to something else. Then he would go back to a similar type feel in the odd time, but there would be something that's just a little bit different that you had to nail. And it just blew his mind that this guy could do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and where I think some of that comes from also is that, let's take a band like Rush, for example. Okay, the people who are the devotees to that style of music, man, they can listen to these songs over and over and over and over and memorize this minutia,
mm-hmm.
but yet be totally blown away when they hear something that really has significantly more consistent looping structure, like an AABA tune, and right. just not hear the order in it at all.
Right.
And that's kind of a fascinating thing that really is a dividing line between those two mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think sometimes too, and I can speak from someone who I don't consider myself a jazz player and just delve occasionally into it. When I was younger, I'd be like, oh man, you know, you got to blow it out. Like, you know, you got to sound like Tony,
mm-hmm.
like on these gigs, because that's what they want. And mm-hmm. there's two problems with that. One is, if you're not living and breathing that stuff, you're not going to be able to play like Tony. So you're already setting yourself up to look like a total chump.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think we also forget, man, you go talk to a lot of heady players like you might play with, and a lot of times on their solos are like, man, no, I just wanted to lay it out there, man.
Yeah.
I want to, my complexity is going to take this where it's going, and I don't want to be distracted by you basically soloing behind me.
Right.
But I think sometimes as an inexperienced person in that genre, when you're put in there, you're like thinking, oh, I got to just take it to another level or mm-hmm. whatever. And that stuff can get really...
I think you're
really
saying,
weird real quick.
I think you're saying that in those situations, you would like to get in the ditch.
I stay in the ditch.
Elvin is another one too. Whenever I hear a recording of Elvin, I'm like, I wish I could sound like that on a gig, but it's just not possible. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the sound and the hugeness of his tone and everything. I'm just like, that's just not, I can't do that.
And even with the people we know, sometimes you can go over their head doing that. You
yeah.
know, like that Elvin thing is just so, it's amazing, but is it appropriate?
Exactly.
Sometimes a rare gig, maybe it is, but
yeah.
I think a really great seasoned jazz player is going to know that it's not.
Right.
But someone who's a little bit inexperienced might think like, oh, it's a jazz gig, man. I got to blow it out, bro.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Right.
Maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you made a good point about the Elvin, man, because I've always thought the exact same thing that you're thinking,
mm-hmm.
is that if you take, I want you to think about some of the greatest jazz drummers in history. And I'm going to go down the wormhole just a little bit, okay? Think about Tony. Think about Roy. Think about Max. Let's just take those three for a second. I'll bet you that we could sit here and within just a few seconds, we could name three or four other people that are really close. That sometimes you listen to them and it's kind of like, oh man, boy, there's a whole bunch of Roy coming out of Bill Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of Tony Williams coming out of Cindy Blackman,
mm-hmm.
right? How many people can you say that about Elvin?
He's a machine. He's his own thing, man.
You know what Anomaly. I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, now that in itself is, again, we're getting off topic a little bit, but
well, that's okay.
That's
because this is
just Shane Watts to be like, he's yeah. a direct Elvin mm-hmm. disciple yeah. kind of thing. But
yeah definitely. I'd say that's about as close as you get.
Yeah.
And
I still feel
again,
him. Yeah.
He is in a setting, the muscular thing, the polyrhythmic thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's encouraged. It's expected.
Mm-hmm.
He's not playing at the Ritz-Carlton in a jazz trio.
Right.
You know, so that he has that advantage besides the obviously putting in the time and shedding and owning Elvin for all the beauty he is.
Mm-hmm.
he's in a setting that he can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, again, knowing, you know, having the discipline to know, you know, on a gig, like, man, I love Elvin, but, you know,
sure.
I don't know if I've ever played a gig that and I could do that.
I've never seen Tane play it like a private hit or anything, but I bet he can play very soft and very yeah. controlled and very appropriate for pretty much any setting there is. Yeah.
Or he just says, no, I don't want to do that.
Or I don't, yeah. No,
and
thanks.
That's fine, too.
That's totally right. Cool.
Let's talk about preparation. Because that's another thing that both disciplines, jazz and rock, we have guys that are great preparers, but there's a slightly different mindset
mm-hmm.
that has to go with each of those disciplines. And they're all, it's a very idiomatic thing that preparation for jazz is going to be different
mm-hmm.
than preparation for like a rock or pop tune. And to kind of harken back to the basic song structure, for example, there is more minutia regarding the actual preparation when it comes for doing a rock tune. Like, let's take an example that we're working on a specific song. You pretty much, if you're going to play that song authentically, you got to nail that groove. Mm-hmm. You got to play what's on the record if you're covering it, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you got to play that groove, or essentially you're not playing that song, right? Whereas, now we go over to the other side of things. If it's a swing tune, it's a swing tune. There's a lot of room for interpretation in that. Now, of course, inside of those songs, there's different parts of the arrangements where, yeah, there's a kick here. There's a hit there. There's that type of stuff. But what kind of follows in between that?
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of room there. Do you have to play the hi-hat on 2 and 4 all the time? Eh, not necessarily. Do you have to feather the bass drum? Nah, not really. Not unless you don't want to. If you're going to play a super contemporary thing, you don't necessarily have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's that. And then where you intrinsically get into a problem, not that we're trying to make this a problem show, but if you do hire Johnny Jazz to sub on your Rupert's gig, how far into that minutia is he going to go? My bet is it's not going to be that far.
More than likely, like, and I've been guilty of this, like, oh, just, yeah, I got the vibe of it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's fine, like on a blues gig, or it's even more appropriate if you're having that mindset on a straight ahead kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, I know what he likes. I know what he's into.
Right.
The vibe.
Yeah.
That's way more open to succeeding versus the other. And I've been guilty of this on pop tunes. Like, oh yeah, I know the vibe of it. And
absolutely. Have you ever had to learn a song that you just absolutely hated and you can't finish it? Like your mind tunes out every time you get to a certain point and you can't learn it?
You just set him up and watch him go.
He's got some
have you ever wished you didn't waste breath for your dying day? You just did that, man. You just wasted, like,
you know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
But I will say this, as far as preparedness and like zooming out a little bit, I feel like assumes that you have a lot of your stuff together, good time, good feel in all styles of music. But I feel like preparing for a rock gig is, or a pop thing, you're preparing for a song, you're learning a song, and preparing for a jazz gig, you're spending your time preparing for like a moment, you know? So you're preparing for the ability to improvise and be creative by, you know, work shedding your independence and your stick control and all these things that we work on our whole lives. So I feel like preparing, it's more specific in a rock side of thing where you're learning the exact arrangement, you know, whereas in jazz, you're learning how to make an arrangement happen in the moment.
Yeah. It's sort of the difference of in a rock setting, you're preparing a speech.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going to go play in a piano trio, you're going to have a conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
And
that's why they pay me the big bucks, John.
What, you're getting paid?
Didn't you hear I got an endorsement with Steel from the Danny Reyes show?
Man.
Dang.
I'm out of here. You guys do what you gotta do. I'm going.
You wanna go Matthews?
Yeah, this is worthless. Big leaguer over here. Just gave me the all of that though, there's a I think sometimes too, the reverence of things, like sometimes we can be guilty of like, oh man, I'm playing with the cats. Oh, it's a more of a blowing gig. It's all, I'm going to take this way more serious versus, and not even speaking genre, but sometimes we're guilty of like, oh man, I'm playing at, let's say we're playing, you know, back when Churchill was open, mm-hmm. I'm bringing out my main kit and my cymbals I love and all that, right. Versus going to play a piano trio. Like, yeah, man, I'll have a ride and a hi hat, and it's just a trio gig. It's kind of like, well, is it?
Yeah,
you know, like, or is that easier load in for you? Mm-hmm. What is it? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, some people frame it like, well, I can be more creative if I just have a kick and a snare. Well, is that really where you're coming from? Mm-hmm. Because when I saw you play at Churchill, you had your amazing, you know, four piece and everything like there. And then, but here it's kind of like, but what that speaks a lot to what we were talking about before we got on about attitude and the whole mindset and respect of something.
Yeah.
You know, are we guilty sometimes of being a little indifferent to certain things? I think so. I'm guilty of it. Yeah.
Try not to be.
Oh, I know, me too. But like, you know, learning four songs for a wedding, mm-hmm. you know, halfway through, I'm like thinking about, you know, this or that, I gotta get my oil changed. I gotta, you know, what was it my wife asked me to do? You know, that's something that we could probably all be better about, mm-hmm. as musicians, like, man, focus, do this thing and not let your love of a style, or if you take a gig, own it.
Absolutely.
You know,
you said, yes.
And there's attitude too.
Yeah.
Like if you're on a rock gig, man, your attitude should be completely different than a jazz gig. It's like, mm-hmm. the rock gig, no, here's where it's going to be.
Right.
I'm the man.
Right.
And you don't outwardly necessarily convey that and create ill will, mm-hmm. but you're the man. Mm-hmm. We're in a jazz gig, like you were saying, you know, like being open to creativity and interaction, which is the beauty of that music.
Yeah.
You can't just be the man.
Absolutely. And just the function of the instruments, I feel like, is a little bit different. I don't mm-hmm. know if I'm skipping ahead.
No, go for it.
On your thoughts. But, I mean, I feel like in straight ahead, the bass quarter note is really a lot more of the timekeeper.
100% it is.
And the...
Oh!
Hey, buddy.
That's Get him
Leo.
A mic.
That's Leo. He agrees.
I'm over here waving my arms like a maniac. And he's like, not... You're not gonna hurt my dad,
and you know, in a rock or pop gig, the drums gotta hold it down, and the bass and drums gotta be right together. But in a jazz setting, you want that bass to be kind of pushing on top, and
that freaking quarter note is mm-hmm. the governor, man.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. and that's a huge switch.
Yep,
and I have to flip that a lot when mm-hmm. I go between.
Yeah, that is gospel, man.
Mm-hmm. But even in that. We know different players that kind of maybe don't grasp that. Like I've played with some bass players who in a straight ahead, quote unquote, sort of setting, mm-hmm. even if it's just this low key, you know, wallpaper music thing, it's like that. I feel they're almost like wanting me to dictate the time,
yeah,
and
right.
I'm going to play better and the thing's going to sound better if the bass player is doing that. So I'm totally with you on
right.
that.
Yeah, players are not going to grasp that unless they fully conceptualize what it is to, you know, to be in that. Hey, buddy. Until they fully conceptualize what it is to actually play successfully inside of those groups. Because that's, again, kind of what we're talking about, man. That would be like, you know, a rock bass player playing in a jazz setting.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. It's definitely a different thing. Now, let's go ahead and let's talk about some real drum related stuff. Now, we kind of just been talking about general music related stuff. Now, what I want to talk about now is the difference in the basic independence for us as drummers of what it takes to create a successful rock groove versus what it's like to create a successful jazz groove. And by the jazz groove, we're talking about more of a swing pattern. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I really want to say about it is I get my hackles up a bit, John, especially I have a student that'll come to me and they'll say,
you shouldn't get your hackles up around students. The lawsuit waiting to happen. Right?
That's why I have windows in the doors, right?
Come on, bro.
But they'll come to me and they'll go, man, I want you to teach me how to play jazz because it's so difficult that if I can play jazz, I can play anything. And the first thing that I say to them, I say, I want you to get it out of your mind that playing jazz is more difficult. I always temper them by saying playing jazz and jazz independence is not intrinsically more difficult. It's more sophisticated. I will give you that, but it is not more difficult. And I then back that up by saying, look, you got to understand something. If you want a good analogy, I want you to think in terms of the basic jazz independence. And let me go ahead and lay that out. We're going to say feathering on the bass drum, jazz ride pattern, two and four on the hi-hat, and some comping with the left hand. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if we think in terms of the rock basic beat, let's just think of one and three on the kick, two and four on the snare, and just some eights either on the hi-hat or cymbal, right? I said, I want you to think of that jazz basic independence as an old school analog key wound metronome. And if you open that thing up in the back, man, you see all the intricacies in there, man. You see these beautiful cogs and weights and different things in there. And they're just working perfectly in harmony and they're creating that perfect beat. And I want you to think of a rock beat as a modern digital metronome, where if you open that up and look in the back, there's just a circuit board and a battery in there. Mm-hmm. Now, both of them do the exact same thing, and both of them play the exact same kind of time and get you to the same point, but one is just more analog and a little more handcrafted, and the other's a little more utilitarian, so to speak. And so that's the way I like to feel about it between those two different styles. I left them speechless.
I don't know. At the risk of losing my non-paying job.
No, you're doing great, John.
that was pretty heady, man.
That was deep.
Thank you. I sort of like to go back to, like, you know, use a 24, 13, 16, or an 18, 12, 14, but I'm a simpleton. You know? I think gear is such a big part of helping you be successful in a thing. And I still am kind of like, when it comes to jazz, I'm still sort of in that. I'm so obsessed with, like, man, I need that ride cymbal that works for me. And it might not work for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, that.
You've got one of my cymbals, so I know it works for me.
Well, yeah, it won't anymore. Just so we are clear, it's not your symbol, like, physically, only financially at this point, because it's not gonna get back to your house probably. Anyway, so all that to say, in that, you know, a very deep but effective way of getting maybe someone to see the difference, but see the fact that we're still talking about music, and we're still kind of the foundation, and we're also still at the end of the day largely responsible for vibe and feel.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, when you do a lot of different gigs with a lot of different people. Like, let's just take a straight ahead gig with the different bass players. Mm-hmm. That in itself can set a tone or set how you approach something.
Absolutely.
So speak to that a little bit, like, you know.
Sure, yeah. I mean, if a bass player's time is very on top, I mean, to me, there's three different, you know, there's on top, there's right on the beat, and then there's kind of behind the beat, which in a swing setting, you really don't want. I mean, that's tough. Mm-hmm. You know, and I actually find that when a bass player is behind the beat, all of a sudden my feathering gets more, it becomes less like a feather and more,
it's labored.
Yeah,
it's a labored feeling.
When I start, mm-hmm, hearing my bass drum, I'm like, mm-hmm, something's wrong here. But you know, when somebody's on top, I can relax. When somebody's right on the beat, I feel an equal part, and when somebody's behind, I feel like I'm having to drive, you know? Whereas, you know, in rock, I feel like there's a few, the bass player can play with your kick. The bass player can complement, play with your kick and complement, and the bass player can play against your kick, right? So those are three different ways that, and you know, a lot of the old Motown stuff, that's an interesting time period because, like, speaking to gear, they're using 18-inch bass drums, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit of a crossover sound. It kind of sounds jazzy, but it's R&B. And, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff where the bass player is playing with and against the bass drum, you know, but it works. And it's like, it's got its own groove. So those guys are playing what I would think would be both their own time, you know, and it's working, it's locking. It's a groove that just locks up. But playing your own time, I think, is where the magic happens in straight ahead music, you know, like Elvin is, for instance, just doing his thing and the bass player's doing his thing. And somehow it's just creating this beautiful magic that you can't really explain.
To speak to your point, man, mm-hmm. it made me think of something. Two of my favorite bass players on the planet that I work with couldn't be more different. But I feel like I play equally great, but different with both of them. How different is it to play with Rodney Jordan and then turn around and play with Ramon Pouzer?
Mm.
It's very different, man, but equally really cool. You know, and the different
man, both of them are the man. Rodney puts it right in down
right
the middle.
Right there. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And there's been times where I feel like Ramon, because he is also cut from a different cloth, also, that he's done a whole lot of like experimental free kind of stuff, you know, because he was with Shannon Jackson for a while, you know, and he has a tendency at times to play a little more behind, which is kind of interesting, man, for doing a straight ahead kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. But yeah, that definitely speaks to your
weird
point.
Like when I think of him, I think he's kind of more driving.
Well, he can be that,
but
too. Maybe,
but he's, that also could be with Ramon, like he felt he needed to.
Yeah.
maybe I think I better drive this. But, you know, I actually, when you talk about the straight ahead thing, and I completely agree with you, you know, I'm like, I am way more relaxed if someone's really driving the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And because I feel like then I'm floating, I can interact more, I can really, you know, lock into speaking a little bit with a soloist, you know, yeah. and what have you. Because it's not this, you know, you're not just like, oh man, I better pull this together and lock it down.
I got to just keep time.
But I kind of feel the same way about groove playing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit the opposite, because mm-hmm. if someone's driving, I'm far from relaxed.
Right.
But bass player's driving, it's like, this sucks.
Yeah.
I'm not digging this at all.
I agree.
And it can be, we get into a little bit of, you know, personal things here. I tend to play a little behind the beat, so that becomes even more of an issue if someone's really driving, you know, because then I'm unnaturally having to compensate.
Yeah.
And that's when music suffers
yeah.
a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, and then, you know, if someone is just morbidly behind the beat, and then again, I'm naturally having to kind of be like, oh, I gotta stay up.
Yeah.
So it in a lot of ways, you know, we're just talking music versus even genre at this point, but we're also talking chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know there's not right or wrong. Because a bass player in a pop setting drives, well, you know, if he's playing with Stuart Copeland, it's going to be magic.
Right.
Because Stuart does that.
Right.
You know, if he's playing with Al Jackson, that might be a little bit of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because so when we talk about these things and right and wrong, we're, even though we're talking conceptually, a lot of it makes sense. A bass player driving on a straight ahead tune, mm-hmm. you know, like right in the pocket on a groove tune. We're still talking about there's a respect and a chemistry and an approach that you can't say it's right or wrong, but you can also, but you know, it's right for you or not.
Yeah.
And I think at this point in our lives and our career, we're so sensitive to that
mm-hmm.
that
and you feel it right away too.
What's that?
You feel it right away.
Oh my God.
You get on a gig and you know in the first 30 seconds.
Yeah.
10 seconds.
And then it's up to you to figure out how to make this work and relax and not get uptight. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a challenge in itself. But mm-hmm. man, I really feel like I'm blessed to play with some people that, you know, I played with a long time. And there's a big thing. We talk about people who have this natural tendency to do this or that, drives, lay back, all that. But man, let's not lose sight of the fact that as a rhythm session, especially, the trust thing is a huge, huge part of it.
Absolutely.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah. I play with someone who doesn't trust me and it's like, yep. Hey, you don't even necessarily have to dig my playing in general.
Yeah.
But tonight, just let's figure this out.
Exactly.
So, you know,
chemistry is everything, man.
Yeah.
That really speaks to that brings both of these styles together, in my opinion, because we think of maybe now more, we think of jazz as like playing standards and pickup gigs and things like that. But where this tradition and this lineage came from, these were bands, you know,
mm-hmm.
and this is where, you know, Miles and Train, like those guys were hardcore bands. I mean, then that's who they played with, and that's where they cut their teeth, and that's where they developed their style, and then they went on to be these amazing studio jazz guys, you know. But yeah, chemistry is everything. You like sit down with a bass player that you've played with for many years. For my guy is Robbie, and I just feel like I have this thing where I hear the initial attack of my kick, and then the bass note just kind of blooms out of it. I'm just, it's like happens consistently. I'm like, mm-hmm. this is beautiful.
I think you guys musically match up well, but there's also that trust thing there too. Like
absolutely.
You never ever would question from the word go on a gig with him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I know it's going to be great. And
yeah.
And then you have that confidence going in too.
Sure.
Which is like,
and even then, man, like you're willing to adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe he's feeling a little on top tonight. Mm-hmm. On this particular tune, even. It could be a bridge, even.
Yeah.
But you go with it as opposed to, like, no, man.
Yeah.
And that's a big part to me of a successful gig is that.
Mm-hmm.
And I find as I get older, too, like, I don't know if I want to take that gig just because I'm not going to get that.
Right.
And I don't say that with attitude, but I say that with, like, not only serving the music, but not having a 3-hour gig feel like a 10-hour gig.
Right.
You know, cause it's just a battle. So you get into the trust thing, the attitude thing, the approach, all of these things factor so much into less about genre, even about music and playing musical and playing just, you know, making it work.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the end of the day, whether you're playing straight ahead or you're playing groove music, you have to check your ego, and you have to, you know, be willing to give and take some, but at the same time, man, you have to be, to know when to be like, no, this is where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as seasoned players, it's easier to kind of get to that point quickly mm-hmm. with someone, but I think we can't lose sight of it. Like a younger player, man, they go play with someone and it just is a disaster. Well, man, that might have just been that you're musically not lining up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not right or wrong, but it can wreck somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in this conversation, if we're talking, you know, some younger guys listening, like, man, you went and played a straight ahead gig and it was just brutal. It might have just been the fact that you guys feel things differently.
Right.
And that's okay.
I routinely talk students off the ledge with exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it could be, you know, a legendary player they're playing with, and all of a sudden they're just like, well, you know what, man? There's probably a monster drummer that doesn't like playing with that guy too.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it's not even right or wrong. It's just musical chemistry. Again,
yeah.
Here we come back to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to tag one thing onto this whole thing about, we kind of gone in a circle a little bit about talking about the independence aspect of it. But another thing that I thought of that I want to add on is that when you think about our terms of pure technique on what it takes to play a successful rock groove versus what it takes to play a successful swing groove, if you think about it, our timekeeping limbs are shifted 180 degrees in importance as far as like with where they stand in a volume hierarchy. Let's say that. How's that? Not necessarily importance. Let's use volume. When we think in terms of rock and pop, right foot, left hand for the right-handed drummer. That's your meat and potatoes, right? That's your bass drum, snare drum. That's the thing that needs to stand out in a backbeat-oriented groove. Your left foot, right hand is pretty much your accompaniment, right? Okay. Think about it from the standpoint of a straight-ahead jazz gig, right? You primarily have right hand playing the time on a cymbal, left foot giving you your de facto backbeat if you're doing two and four. Left hand in particular, right, is going to be more of an accompaniment thing. Even call it comping.
Color.
Right, yeah. And then the thing that always gives every rock drummer trying to play a basic straight ahead beat fits is that feathering on the bass drum. It just blows, especially if you're playing on, like you said, a small, if you're playing an 18-inch bass drum with either just a felt strip or no muffling at all in there.
Yeah.
It's a disaster for the first little bit, man, trying to get that bass drum to sit underneath all that, right? That's a big deal, man, trying to get guys to play that. And that's a, and it's just, like I said, it's a 180 degree difference. And that's why also, if you want to throw it, if you want to throw it the other way around, that's why when you hear Buddy Rich trying to play those rock tunes, it just, it doesn't cut it, man.
Yeah.
Man, I found something out. Like, I had this mindset, you know, coming more from, my jazz background's okay. I know enough to not get in too much trouble. But I, in recent years, in like the last 10 years or so, yeah, I always had this mindset like, you know, it's just square and cheesy to play any kick drum on a swing tune. Like, and man, I'm over that. I don't really give a crap about whether it's square or not. Like, is it grooving?
Yeah.
And man, it's amazing how sometimes you just, if you're struggling, you know, you go and you start feathering a little bit and it just kind of brings everybody together. And man, that's something that I needed to get out of my own way.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, playing one and three even on a kick drum on a swing tune, you're not burying it. You're not dictating it like a funk tune or something. But man, it just sometimes it can really bring things.
And I've been telling my students too that it's the volume of it should be underneath an acoustic upright bass.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really, that's what your goal is. But all the greats did it, man. And
a presence first, versus a
yeah. Kina was the first person that told me about that when I took a couple lessons with him. He's like, man, you should really check it out. Because I was very against it coming out of college and stuff and like super into New Breed and doing all this independent stuff. And like, why would I do that? It would like lock me in, you know, to something. And then you slowly, and I'm just now getting to the point where I kind of have a very distinct feather to accented kind of thing. Like, I've something I still work on all the time. But I feel like when you really do it right, it's just a thing underneath the bass, and it's beautiful, and it really does, it centers the band. I couldn't agree more,
man. The first time that I legitimately had my mind blown apart was in probably, I think it's 1989. I saw Tony's Quintet at a little club in Knoxville called El Garouz, and I sat as close to Tony's kit as from here to your fireplace, which is about 10 feet.
Wow.
And he had that infamous Gretsch, what would it be, 7-piece set, the 2-up, 3-down, black dot heads. You could... 24-inch kick. And man, when they were setting his drums up, I got there earlier, his tech came out, had his drum set up, took 2 nails... and drove them in front of the bass drum.
Dang.
And I sat there and looked, because he had clear heads on the bass drum. He freaking feathered the bass drum all night. Tony Williams feathered the bass drum. And that's when the first time, man, I was like, I got to start doing this all the time now. Because the freaking Tony Williams, and especially playing at the volume that he was playing at, and the style that he was playing in that quintet at that time, I was like, I got it. I mean, he had on that gig, man, he had Bob Hurst was subbing for Ira Coleman on that gig. Bob Hurst had an Ampeg amp on a bar stool, you know, one of the real tall ones, sitting up to where it was nearly ear level so he could hear himself. I mean, just freaking blasting.
That's awesome.
You know, and Tony was feathering the bass drum. So that's just my little quick feathering Credence thing.
That's
there.
Awesome.
Yeah. Now, we've already talked, we kind of alluded a little bit about gear. Mm. And what I want to do is I want to put together the concept of gear and touch, because you can't separate them really, right? Mm. And so I want to first talk about what we'd call like our traditional jazz kind of kit. And I want to use one of our favorite traditional guys as a template for this. I want to talk about Kenny Washington again, okay? Now, let's take the traditional jazz drum set. We're going to say it's 18-inch bass drum, 12-inch rack tom, 14-inch floor tom. And for the most part, and we're going to use Kenny as our template here, tuned very high, right?
Mm-hmm.
Drums tuned very high. Now we go to the cymbals. For the most part, we want to think in terms of cymbals in general being overall lower pitch. More of a blend, less of a cut, more of a blend. Of course, you want stick definition, but you want to have a nice spread underneath, to use the old Mel Lewis terminology, so the band can sit mm-hmm. on top of your groove, right? And now we get to the touch aspect of what it's like to play on that drum set. In particular, what I like to think of, and you can use this both in terms with brushes and with sticks, is to be able to play at a manageable volume level that sits with an acoustic bass, with an acoustic piano, where you're not blowing over top of them.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have those drums tuned up high enough so that you can play with a certain touch and those drums will articulate so that they'll speak. If those drums are tuned down super low with pinstripe heads on them,
you gotta hit them.
You got to hit them to get any kind of articulation, to get any kind of resonance out of them, right? So those two things go hand in hand. And then likewise, if you want to flip that around, okay, think about from the standpoint, if you're playing a rock gig, you've got to first hit those drums so that they will open up and so that they will speak in a characteristic tone.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just rat-a-tat, barely tapping on them, you lose that intangible of the characteristic of what it's really like for those drums to open up and what they're supposed to sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, if they are tuned up too high, they will choke themselves out. And so that has always been my concept as far as like when you have those two different polar opposites of drums, that you need to have them set up a certain way if you're going to have that characteristic feel, sound, tone approach to it.
Yeah. And it's very, very tough to, on some of my experiences, when you're playing with a jazz quartet, trio, or something, and somebody calls a pop tune, and you have to fake it with an 18-inch bass drum and an upright bass, and, you know, it's just, it's very hard. It doesn't feel good.
At all, man.
Feels really rough. But I think speaking to the bass drum thing, to me, is like, that's the biggest feel change between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you got to really, if you want to hop styles and jump between the two, you got to be able to play off the head and bury the beater. Mm-hmm. You have to have both of those down really, really well. Because if you have a completely open 18, burying the beater and hearing that little
it's
basketball
like a buzz.
Bounce,
yeah.
buzz uh-huh. thing, it's the worst. It feels terrible.
I've gotten to the point, I don't even like playing a bossa nova on an open bass drum.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a completely different thing. But then when you get on a nice 22 or 24 that's dead enough where you can bury the beater, it feels so good.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I remember one time, man, you and I were talking about you were going somewhere to do a gig where backline was provided, and they gave you a 24, and you were setting up, and I was talking to you on your phone. You were going, "Oh man, I got my freaking fingers crossed that we're just doing all groove music tonight." Because if you had to do that hour and a half of dinner set on a 24.
And the Tom's probably had pinstripes or emperors. I'll tell you what, man. Careful what you wish for. I did a gig one time with a 24 as a backline kit, and we did 4 hours of like blowing out 2 and 4.
Yeah.
And that last set, I was like, I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
You don't think about that extra couple inches and that extra little bit of air over the course of a long gig.
Wear you out.
I'll give me a 24 all day to record with or do an hour, you know, original set. And it's amazing. But
yeah.
Woo. I got my butt kicked one night playing a 24. Like, but man, there's just sort of a, I hate, and we're stuck on it on the corporate thing more than anything. Is like, even though I wish we just get rid of it, we still do some standards, and I'm using like a 22, 12, 16 kit, and it's tuned down. It's just uninspiring.
It's tough.
You know, it's just like, I'll bring a different ride cymbal, but it's still like, it's just not, I play different when I have, you know, a little kit.
Well, you're inspired by the sound. I mean, totally. I totally get inspired by the sound of the kit.
That, no question.
Yeah.
You know, like just the vibe being right equipment wise makes all the difference.
Yeah.
But what about, okay, like I want to ask you about like a hybrid kind of gig.
Okay.
Like maybe you're going to do, you know, half the night, you know, is going to be pretty much straight ahead, and then you're going to do some lighter R&B and groove stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What works for you, and what keeps you out of that, oh, this is a miserable mindset?
I think it depends on the group, to be honest. And if it's more of a an R&B centered or a you know, groove group that's pulling off jazz, I'd rather have the kit for the group, for the groove, and fake the jazz. You know what I mean? And if it's more of a vice versa, I'd rather have the jazz kit and fake the groove stuff a little bit. So I think it depends on the other musicians on the gig and what, you know, because typically, you know, on a wedding or something like that, it'll be like 20% jazz and 80% groove. So right. I'll bring a big kit and just, the jazz will suffer a little bit.
You get through it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But I'd rather that than trying to play 24 karat magic on an 18.
Ooh. With a sequence.
We need a moment of silence.
Yeah.
Which I hear is what people do on these gigs.
And I'm sorry, but I got to interject here. I'm sick of this, like, man, I got an 18, man. It's booming, bro. Just put a mic on it. It's fine.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just don't want to carry in a 22.
I actually have a theory that the bebop sizes probably started from New York. Right, from getting the drums to the gigs,
like fit in a cab,
in a trunk of a cab,
so it creates a sound.
I think that's actually. I think it was created out of that.
I've heard that more than
necessity,
and it's a reasonable theory.
Yeah.
Well, those old guys, man, they played 26s a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they were on a bus going
right
city to city and all that. So it's versus the once you got into that bebop thing, these guys are kind of staying put and you know playing 52nd Street, 7 different clubs and all that, but they didn't have a car.
Yeah.
You know, getting your stuff Steve on a Jordan train. Didn't even have a driver's license. You know, that's the New York thing.
Deitch doesn't either.
Yeah. Like, they're just like, don't drive. Yeah. You know, so your transport is a big issue. So
that's probably where a lot of the sound came from.
Exactly. And also, you think, like, I've seen pictures of like Max where he's got a tom upside down, and it's that side of the head is black with stick marks.
Yeah,
yeah.
He just kept cranking those heads, and like, I don't want to buy heads.
Yep.
I was just going to throw. I was going to pull the curtain back and reveal the wizard on one other thing. Also, I was talking to a guy up in New York not too long ago, and we were talking about nylon tip drumsticks. About how there's certain guys that Kenny Washington, as a matter of fact, is one of Farnsworth. Some of those other guys,
Eric Harlan,
he uses a nylon. And they're like, man, do you know how much drumsticks cost in Manhattan?
Oh, yeah.
They're like $12.50 a pair, you know, $13 a pair. There you go.
I don't want chip beads.
Right?
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So, you know, you get the old necessities, the mother of invention, so to speak.
That's why they kept looking for darker and darker cymbals, right? Because they were using nylon tips of cheap sons of bitches. we're really getting to the, we're getting down, figuring out why this gear has become.
Yeah, the root of this stuff, man.
Yeah.
It wasn't vibe and coolness. It was like necessity. And
yeah,
I'd rather eat and have nylon tip sticks.
Right.
I like to eat.
You get like 7 dumplings for the price of a stick.
We're like, awesome. This show has become sort of the X-Files of drumming podcasts. Now we've uncovered the mysteries of life in this last hour.
Yeah.
You guys got anything you want to add? I think we've probably done some good today.
I'd like to hear one other thing about as far as recording goes.
Okay.
You record a lot of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And amazing players,
mm-hmm.
but such different vibe and, you know, tuning and all that. And what, you know, as an engineer, I know you have to be open-minded to being like, hey, Burroughs versus Justin,
mm-hmm.
you know, it, the touch, the feel, the vibe, the sound.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, like, as an engineer, you have to kind of let go of your playing side of things.
Right.
But, you know, the myth of, hey, it's got to be coated in Bassard. It's got to be tuned to the hilt. It's got to be a really dark old K.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not, because, like, you know, some guys really like an old A that's a little brighter, you know, that kind of thing. So
totally.
Getting out of the way of these myths and all that, when you are recording guys, are you surprised a lot of times about gear choice and how it translates and how a different touch and
yeah, absolutely. I mean, but all these guys you're mentioning are just, you know, badasses and have great tone. But oftentimes guys will come in with too dark of a setup. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it's like, it might sound great in a club or something, but there are times where it's like, gee, I can't even hear that cymbal, or it's all attack, or it's all pinging or something like that. Or it's right. not, you know, so like the idea of engineering to me is kind of you're a little bit of an arranger, you know, of sound, not of the music, but of the actual sound you're having to arrange. So if a cymbal is buried within what the piano's doing, then it's not really working. But the other good thing about me being a drummer is these guys really trust my ear, and I'll be like, hey, can we throw a little pillow on that bass drum? I mean, I know it's supposed to be open, but
something's not translating.
It's ringing for 4 seconds or whatever.
Like cymbal wise too, like, you know, hey, come in and listen. You have that advantage too. Like, look,
that's actually the best trick is let me play that back for you.
Yeah. And then they realize.
Yeah.
I was talking with Burroughs one time, and I like kind of spready, real thin, real dark cymbals because it hides my lack of technique. To honest, you know, seriously, I think that's why I like him. But he's like, man, yeah, but that's fine, but you're not gonna hear it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
even in a piano trio, man, that cymbal sounds amazing when we're sitting here playing it, but yeah. It's gone.
Yeah,
in 8 bars you're gonna look like you're playing air.
Isn't that the impossible thing about cymbal shopping though? You can't possibly pick out a cymbal without a band, without a trio.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think.
Yeah. It is such a, I'm just fascinated by, sometimes we have these, again, the myth of sound and all that. And someone put something interesting, like we, you know, we talk about these old K's and they're dirty and guys bury them in the yard and all that. And one time a friend of mine's like going, dude, Elvin walked down to the Gretsch factory and had some shiny ass K right before that, you know, iconic song you love.
Yeah.
It was bright and killing and new. And
yep.
And we think it has to be all this dark on it. So we need to get out of our own way. Sometimes we have these like old myths of things, but what about our ear?
Right.
Yeah. You know, well, there's a perfect example.
Same thing about microphones. Everybody wants a vintage U47 or whatever, but when they were recording, they were new.
That's true.
So, you know.
But I mean, now an old a specific model is proven to be
right.
Well, that okay.
Yeah,
you know that yeah. works. But it could but have
it's
been
not,
made.
The capsule's not aged back then. You
yeah,
know?
It right. could
not
have been. Like, it could have been made 4 months ago. If it's working, it's working.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Such a funny thing. I think gear wise, even playing wise too, though, the vibe of like,
mm-hmm.
oh man, you got to just play straight quarters or man, you can't do we've talked about that 3-point pattern.
Mm-hmm.
To me, when I play that 3-point pattern swings better.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really need you to say like, yeah, but that's wasted motion or whatever. No, it's like what feels good.
Yeah.
Cause at the end of the day, if it feels good, you're going to have, you're going to be more successful as a player and interacting with other people.
Jazz police.
The rules and that are wacky.
Yeah.
You know, but I love the idea of you get to hear so many different players.
I do. And it really, the really interesting thing is the piano. I have this awesome piano in the studio, and I get to hear all these different players play the exact same instrument. And it's night and day from one player. That's just unbelievable.
That's incredible.
It's the same key hitting the same string on the same mics, but it's just every player plays that thing completely differently.
Every acoustic instrument, all of them I shouldn't say it that way. All acoustic instruments, the way the motion, of course, the velocity that you strike them is going to be different, right? It's just like if you make a short stabby motion, you're going to get a short stabby sound. If you make a nice round motion, you're going to get a nice round sound. And then everybody has their own way of doing it, whether it's on a piano, whether it's on acoustic bass, whether it's on a snare drum or a cymbal.
Yeah. We could all go play 8 bars of the exact same thing on that Rodgers kit sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to sound amazingly different.
Let's go do that.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah. No, I don't want to do that. No, I need to sleep. I don't need my shrink to make more money matching up my 8 bars of you freaks. But no, all that to say, man, it really is. I think, and I'm not going to just say for young guys, just encourage people, man, find your thing and do your thing and don't get locked into this nonsense, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, like, sometimes you're going to work out with a player. It might be some legendary guy you dreamed of playing with. If it doesn't work, man, that doesn't mean you suck.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, what you were doing was wrong.
Yeah.
It's just the chemistry and the reaction. But again, and then back to styles too, man. I really, really, you can't discount attitude. Mm-hmm. Like when you're playing a rock and roll tune, it's like, play it like Dave Grohl, if that's what it's supposed to be.
Right.
Just raw and nasty and animalistic. And then if you're, you know, when you're playing a straight ahead tune, man, sit, lay back, let it float. You know, it's mm-hmm. okay. The attitude is so important in style and in success of music to me.
Mm-hmm. In so many ways, we've come full circle with now we're getting back in the ditch.
There you go. But even ditch aside, man, touch, attitude, mindset, you know, I think sometimes we have such preconceived notions about even going into a gig.
Yeah.
I'm so guilty of that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's insecurity. Sometimes it's like, oh, I know what they want. No, you don't. You know,
right.
Man, we need to be more mindful of openness in creating successful musical.
Dustin Hoffman had a great quote about the way he starts every take when he's acting. He says, start at zero, end at zero. So you always walk into that take fresh. At least that's what he wants. Mm-hmm. I love that. I try to apply that to music. Every take, if you're in the studio, every gig, start at zero, end at zero. No, mm-hmm. no preconceived notions. That's my goal, at least. It doesn't always happen, but
right.
You know, I think that's great.
Yeah, because oftentimes other opinions factor into where zero is, and that's an incredible thing, and if you're allowed to do that,
yeah,
amazing things are going to happen.
Yeah,
we're not always allowed necessarily to.
That's true.
You know, sometimes we're expected, or there's some other opinions that are going to dictate it. But
I got a gig later at the Coca-Cola headquarters. I can't really start at zero.
No, you gotta bring it. If it's anything like that coffee you just gave me too, if you drink some of that Coke, man, you're gonna be the edgy guy.
Yeah.
What is in that coffee, by the way?
It's just a little bit of meth.
I told you I saw that Walter White doll.
I can feel my
there.
Teeth loosening as I speak, man. Like, yeah, I think you're right.
This sounds a good place to land the plane, Joe. Right.
Only because I know where I'm going next will I say we can end this conversation.
I thought this was a heck of a good show, guys.
Thank you guys for having me.
Shoot, man. Our pleasure. The third mic thing is going to take off someday. Right?
I think eventually we're going to let the guests eat, too. which is great. You know, you're kind of a guinea pig now. Like, we're trying to train ourselves. You know,
you guys are great.
Well, guys, thanks so much for listening to the show. We always appreciate your listenership. As always, if you want to find out more about us, head on over to our website. We are at drummersweeklygroovecast.com. There you can find the amalgamation of everything that is this show. You can listen to all of our episodes. You can see our videos. You can manage your social media accounts on there. And you guys are indeed reaching out to us there through email. We appreciate it. We love it when you hear from you guys. And also, John, I forgot to mention to you the other day when I was talking about this. The listeners are coming through with some very nice reviews on iTunes.
Oh, nice.
Gotta love it, man.
That's good.
Yeah, it's just fantastic.
Thank
you. Yeah, we do. We really appreciate that. So, all right, guys. Well, that's going to do it for this week. We appreciate you, Marlon. Man, you were great, brother.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Yeah.
You know, your time and your insight, and you know how I feel about you, so that's just really... That means a lot.
Thanks, man.
And
appreciate that.
Don't hold that against him, though.
No. Don't hold anything against me. you might not be able to wash it clean again.
All right, guys. Thanks again for listening. We appreciate it. We'll see you all next week.
Peace.
Bye. Let me stop.